Picture this. It's Paris, 1983. You've got this 23-year-old student sitting in this freezing, totally unauthorized back room at the old Saint-Genevieve school.
And absolutely zero budget.
Right, zero budget. He's just working on this single scavenged computer that everyone else had basically abandoned. So welcome to this deep dive into the book, Jan LeCun, Father of Artificial Intelligence. And today we're specifically focusing on chapter two, The Error Flowing Backward.
It's such a great chapter.
It really is, because today's mission is to figure out how the absolute foundation of modern AI was built. I mean, it wasn't made in some glamorous Silicon Valley tech hub.
No, not at all.
It was built in the bitter cold of what we call the AI winter, right? Back when the scientific mainstream thought neural networks were just a complete dead end.
Yeah, and to really grasp the gravity of that freezing back room, I mean, we have to look at the academic climate of the 1980s.
Right.
The field of AI was just entirely dominated by symbolism.
Meaning rule-based AI, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you weren't manually hard coding these strict logical rules into a machine, you weren't getting a dime of funding.
Wow.
Ever since Marvin Minsky and Seymour Papert published their big critique in 1969.
Right, their critique of the perceptron.
Yeah, where they basically proved the severe mathematical limitations of early single-layered neural networks. After that, the entire field just flatlined.
Just totally died overnight.
Pretty much. Working on neural networks was basically academic career suicide. So, this student in that room, Jan LeCun, he was throwing his time at a problem the whole world had already written off.
Well, let's actually look at the mechanics of that problem,
Right.
because it's the specific technical hurdle that caused the AI winter in the first place.
Right, the hidden layer issue.
Exactly. So Frank Rosenblatt's 1960s single-layer perceptron, it failed at complex tasks. And everyone knew that to fix this, you needed multiple layers of artificial neurons, right?
Yeah, but the moment you add layers, you create these things called hidden layers right in the middle of the network.
Right. So for you listening, imagine a factory. You've got raw materials coming in at the front door, right? That's your input. And a finished product going out the back, which is your output.
Okay, I like this analogy.
But in the middle, you have all these middle managers, and they represent the hidden layers.
Right, and because those middle layers are hidden, if the final product comes out totally flawed, you only know a mistake was made at the very end of the line.
You just see a broken product.
Exactly. You have no idea which specific middle manager dropped the ball or, how much they actually contributed to the error.
Right.
So how do you teach a network of thousands of interconnected nodes to correct its work if you can't isolate the instructions each node needs?
You can't. Or at least the scientific community at the time thought it was mathematically impossible to train all those multiple layers simultaneously.
He really did.
But LeCun didn't look for the answer in computer science, which I think is so fascinating. He looked at rocket trajectory and control engineering.
Yeah, he dug into this old mathematical tool called Lagrange multipliers.
Lagrange
Yeah,
multipliers.
so in aerospace engineering, this math was used to calculate the optimal path for a rocket, like breaking through the atmosphere.
Yeah, okay.
It relies heavily on partial derivatives to just constantly calculate these tiny, tiny adjustments in the trajectory.
Okay, I mean, I struggle to see how calculating the optimal arc of a rocket in the 1960s translates to teaching a computer to read a handwritten number in the 1980s. Those feel like totally disconnected fields.
Oh, they do on the surface, for sure. But LeCun realized there's this profound symmetry between a rocket finding its optimal physical trajectory through space
Right.
and a neural network finding the optimal mathematical weights for its data. The rocket uses those partial derivatives to ask, well, if I adjust this thruster by 1%, how does it affect my final destination?
Oh, wow. Okay, so he applied that same exact logic to the factory of middle managers,
Exactly.
which actually brings us to the title of the chapter, The Error Flowing Backward.
Yes, backpropagation.
Right. He figured out how to use the chain rule of calculus to measure an error at the output. So, say the network misreads a handwritten 3 as a 5.
Right, a classic error.
He calculated that specific error margin and then used the chain rule to step backward through the network. He basically goes to last middle manager and says, hey, you made the curve of the 3-2 round.
And then that manager calculates their own adjustment and tells the person behind them, well, you gave me the wrong pixel weight.
Right, just chaining backward, layer by layer, all the way to the raw input.
So the error doesn't flow forward, it flows backward. The blame is distributed proportionally. That is the entire essence of backpropagation.
It's brilliant. But I mean, implementing this in 1983 was just brutal.
Oh, yeah.
Computers at the time were incredibly slow at processing decimal math, floating point operations. So to even test this theory on that scavenged machine in his freezing room, LeCun had to compromise.
He hand-coded the entire backpropagation program in binary.
Which is insane, just zeros and ones line by line so the processor could actually handle it.
It was this massive physical and intellectual grind. I mean, he had this dilapidated machine, but inside it, the method for teaching multilayered neural networks was actually finally working.
But here's the thing, if you're a lone student working without official funding or even like a fully qualified PhD advisor at the time, your work doesn't matter if no one sees it.
That's the tragic reality of
Yeah.
academia, yeah.
But the transition out of that isolation started in February 1985.
Okay.
It was at this multidisciplinary workshop in the snowy Alps at a retreat called Les Hauches.
Right, and traditionally, Les Hauches was this strict sanctuary for physicists, wasn't it?
Exactly. But suddenly you had neuroscientists, psychologists, and AI researchers all making the trek up this mountain.
Wait, what caused physicists to suddenly care about neural networks? Because that sounds like another massive leap across disciplines.
It was a huge leap, and it was entirely triggered by John Hopfield.
Okay, right.
So in 1982, Hopfield published this landmark paper linking neural networks to the physics of something called spin glass.
Spin glass. Yeah, in solid-state physics, it refers to the disordered arrangement of magnetic materials. Hopfield basically demonstrated that just as electrons in a magnetic material push and pull on each other until they settle into a stable, low-energy state.
A neural network processes chaotic inputs until it settles into a stable solution or memory.
Precisely. He rewrote artificial neural networks in the language of physics.
Oh, so the physicists were suddenly captivated because the math was finally speaking their language.
Exactly.
Okay, so this sets the stage for what feels like a scene straight out of a movie. During an afternoon tea break at this Alpine retreat, LeCun approaches a young biophysicist named Terry Sajowski.
Right.
And LeCun pulls this crumpled notebook out of his pocket. And inside this notebook is all of his backpropagation math derived from the rocket control engineering, all written out by hand.
And you have to understand the stakes of that brief interaction are just massive.
Why?
Because at that exact time, across the Atlantic, Sajalski and another researcher, Geoffrey Hinton, were desperately struggling to get this exact multilayer math working.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Hinton had been spending his nights on a wildly expensive Lisp machine.
Which was like a top-of-the-line computer just for AI research, right?
Yeah, super specialized. And he was trying to fix this broken code originally written by David Ruhmelhart in 1982. They knew the theory could work, but they hadn't successfully published a working model.
So suddenly, Sajowski is looking at a crumpled notebook, realizing this unfunded French student has just solved it independently on a junk computer.
Yeah, Sajowski was so stunned he didn't even wait. He called Hinton from the airport on his way home just to tell him about the student with the notebook.
That is incredible. So Sajowski knows this kid in Paris has the golden ticket, but Hindi is the one giving a massive keynote in Paris 4 months later, right? In June 1985.
Right, at the Cognitiva conference.
Yeah, so Hinton knows the theory is solved, but he doesn't actually know who the student is.
Exactly. And Hinton is presenting on Boltzmann machines. And just to provide a bit of context for you listening, a Boltzmann machine is a type of probabilistic neural network that uses thermal noise again, borrowing from physics to avoid getting trapped in local minimums during learning.
Right, it was cutting-edge connectionist theory at the time, and the room is just absolutely packed.
And LeCun is standing way in the back of the room. He's just 25 years old.
Right, and after the talk, Hinton turns to the conference organizer and asks, "Hey, is there a young fellow named Jan LeCun in the room?"
I love this part.
And from the back of the crowd, LeCun throws his hand up and just shouts, "I am here."
I mean, when you are surviving an academic winter, recognition from a global pioneer like Hinton is profound.
Oh, absolutely.
And the very next day, they sat down for lunch over these steaming plates of couscous at a North African restaurant in Paris. Hinton had started his career in psychology. LeCun started in control engineering.
Two total outcasts from completely different fields.
Yeah, who had both been entirely marginalized by the mainstream rule-based AI community.
And sitting at that table, they realize their foundational philosophy is just identical. They both believed that intelligence isn't some rigid list of rules you program into a machine.
Right.
It's a fluid pattern of connections a machine has to learn for itself, through exposure.
Yeah, and that lunch was the start of a lifelong alliance. But, as we look at the historical timeline, we really do have to examine the controversy surrounding this era impartially.
Right, we should definitely touch on that.
Because Jürgen Schmidhuber, who became a very prominent critic in the field, he strongly argues that the modern algorithm for backpropagation did not originate with Hinton or Sanowski or LeCun.
Schmidhuber's critique is that the narrative of the 1980s is essentially a story of rediscovery, right?
Precisely. Schmidhuber points out that the fundamental math for backpropagation was actually published by a Finnish mathematician named Seppo Lenama back in 1970.
Wow, 1970.
Yeah, and the concept of a functional multi-layer learning network was actually built and used by Alexei Vakhenko in Ukraine even earlier in 1965.
That early. But wait, what about the rocket math, the control engineering LeCun borrowed?
Well, Schmidhuber notes that theorists like Arthur Bryson and Yu-Chi Ho had published those exact partial derivative formulas in 1969, specifically to optimize rocket fuel.
Oh, I see.
So the critique is that these breakthroughs in the 80s were simply old math being applied, just because computational power was finally catching up.
So we have to ask what this means for you, the listener, trying to make sense of AI history. Like, does it erase LeCun's achievement?
Well, the consensus seems to be that it highlights a really common phenomenon in science, right? When the time is ripe, an idea will often spring up in multiple places.
Right, the math existed, yes. The rocket engineers were using it to save fuel, but they weren't looking at those formulas and seeing a way to train artificial neurons to read human handwriting.
Exactly. It's the synthesis of the mathematical tool and the novel application that actually shifts paradigms. The isolated researchers who believed in neural networks, they called themselves connectionists, they were slowly finding each other and applying these tools in totally new ways.
There was this growing underground camaraderie. Like in July 1986, there was the summer school at Carnegie Mellon University.
Oh yeah, that was a big deal.
It acted as a haven for these academic outcasts. And LeCun attended, but his English was really poor at the time, and he felt incredibly intimidated by the whole environment.
Yeah, and another researcher there, Michael I. Jordan, actually pulled out a guitar and played a French chanson by Georges Brassens, specifically to make LeCun feel welcome.
That's amazing.
It's a small detail, but it really shows how tight-knit this connectionist tribe was becoming against the broader academic current.
And LeCun needed that grit. I mean, jump to April 1987, it was time for him to defend his PhD in Paris. And true to his sort of DIY nature, he had built this wind-powered sand sled.
As one does.
Right. He rode it recklessly and completely shattered his ankle. So he shows up to defend his PhD on crutches.
And the makeup of his jury is fascinating. You've got Jacques Patras sitting there, who is a giant of the symbolist, rule-based AI movement.
Right.
Right alongside Geoffrey Hinton, the champion of neural networks. And LeCun systematically defended the mathematical completeness of backpropagation.
And he earned a standing ovation from both sides of the aisle. He effectively bridged the gap.
He really did. And that cleared the path for his move in July 1987 to Toronto, Canada, to become a postdoctoral researcher under Hinton.
Because Hinton's lab was essentially the last well-funded refuge for connectionists.
Right. But the most incredible detail from this period isn't just the theoretical papers. It's the sheer engineering hustle.
Oh, absolutely.
LeCun began this deep collaboration with a brilliant young French mathematics student named Léon Botou.
But keep in mind, LeCun is in Toronto and Botou is in France.
Yeah.
And they aren't using massive university mainframes to collaborate.
Right.
They're using personal Commodore Amiga computers.
Right, just basic home computers.
And to send their C code back and forth across the Atlantic, they hacked into Minitel terminals.
Now, this is wild.
Yeah. If you aren't familiar with 1980s French tech, Minitel was this incredibly early pre-worldwide web network where households had these little bulky terminals plugged into their phone lines.
Basically used for booking train tickets, right? Or looking up phone numbers.
Exactly. Yeah. So LeCun and Botou physically modified the serial ports on these train ticket machines, turning them into makeshift modems just to transmit raw binary code over analog phone lines.
I mean, that is just incredible.
Yeah.
And using this patched together transatlantic connection, they built a software framework called SN, or Simulator Neuronal.
And what SN did was revolutionary at the time. It allowed researchers to snap different neural network components together, like modular building blocks.
Right, and the software would automatically link the complex calculus required for the backpropagation learning process.
Which is huge, because if you work in AI today or follow the industry, you know PyTorch is the absolute industry standard for deep learning.
Oh, yeah.
The ideological root of PyTorch, its distant object-oriented ancestor, is that exact SN framework built on two Amigas and a hacked train ticket terminal.
It's just wild to think about. So the engineering hurdle was solved.
Yeah.
But LeCun faced a new immediate roadblock in Toronto.
Right.
He had the math. He had the SN software framework. But he lacked training data.
Which you need.
Modern AI relies on massive data sets of millions of images.
Yeah.
LeCun had almost nothing.
So what did he do? He sat at his Amiga computer, took his clunky computer mouse, and literally drew letters on the screen, pixel by pixel, to create his own raw data.
Just painstakingly drawing them. But that introduces a massive mechanical flaw called overfitting.
Right. Can you explain overfitting?
Yeah. So when you have a powerful neural network but a very small amount of data, the network is lazy.
Yeah.
It just memorizes the specific examples.
Okay.
It learns the exact pixel arrangement of the specific A you drew.
Mm-hmm.
But if you show it an A drawn by someone else where the pixels are slightly shifted, the network completely fails to recognize it.
Because it hasn't learned the concept of the letter. It has just memorized a photograph. So to force the network to learn the actual concept, LeCun took the few letters he had manually drawn and artificially rotated them.
Oh, that's smart.
He scaled them up, he shrunk them down, he tilted them slightly, and then fed them back into the machine. He basically tricked the computer into thinking it was seeing entirely new examples of human handwriting.
Because he didn't have enough data, he invented data augmentation.
Exactly.
And data augmentation is an absolutely fundamental staple of all modern deep learning. Every major model today uses variations of this technique to artificially expand training sets.
It's everywhere.
Yeah. And this augmented data set the stage for a historic architectural experiment. LeCun tested three different network designs to see which could read the letters best.
Right.
He tried a fully connected network, a locally connected one, and finally a network where he forced the artificial neurons to share their mathematical weights across the image.
Okay, we really need to unpack this concept of sharing weights because it's the breakthrough that makes machine vision possible.
Yes, it introduces spatial invariance.
Right, so if a human looks at a page and sees the number 3 in the top left corner, it's a 3.
Right.
If the number moves to the bottom right corner, it's still a 3. We have spatial invariance. But to a machine, shifting the number 2 inches to the right changes the entire raw input vector.
Because the grid of pixels is completely different now.
Exactly.
A standard neural network would treat that shifted 3 as a completely new, unrecognized object. It would have to relearn what a 3 looks like in every single possible location on the page.
Which requires an astronomical amount of computational power.
Huge amounts.
So by forcing the network to share its weights, LeCun essentially created a feature detector that slides across the entire image.
Oh.
The network learns the pattern of the 3 itself and applies that knowledge uniformly, regardless of where the 3 is located.
So it saved massive amounts of computing power.
And it worked flawlessly.
It was a monumental shift.
Yeah.
I mean, this experiment was the first practical demonstration of a convolutional neural network, or a CNN.
The famous CNNs.
Yeah, CNNs are literally the eyes of modern artificial intelligence. The ability of a computer to recognize a tumor in an MRI scan, or for a self-driving car to recognize a pedestrian in the street, traces its lineage directly back to this experiment.
Back to the shared weights and the hand-drawn letters on the Amiga.
Exactly. And while LeCun was proving this with images, Hinton was proving similar principles with audio and speech recognition.
So together they were building this undeniable momentum for neural networks, even while the broader academic world continued to ignore them.
Right. And this momentum brings us to late 1987 at McGill University in Montreal.
Okay.
LeCun is invited to present his findings. He stands at the chalkboard, filling it with the complex partial derivatives of his shared weight theory, basically mathematically proving how machines can learn internal representations of the visual world.
And sitting in the very front row is a young master's student. When the talk ends, this student raises his hand and starts asking incredibly sharp, piercing questions. I mean, he isn't just asking about images. He's asking about how to apply this math to time series data and contextual flow.
And LeCun was struck by the brilliance of the questions, because that young student in the front row was Yoshua Bengio.
Wow. This is the moment the Trinity is completed.
Yeah. Jan LeCun, Jeffrey Hinton, and Yoshua Bengio. The three men who would go on to trigger the deep learning revolution and eventually share the Turing Award, they were finally intellectually connected.
The journey of the air flowing backward had made its way from a freezing room in Paris over the Alps, across the Atlantic, and into the minds that would completely reshape the modern world.
It is an incredible narrative of persistence.
It really is. And it leaves us with a final thought for you to ponder as you step back into your day. Think about the origins we've just explored. the very engine of modern artificial intelligence, the technology reshaping our global economy, was forged on scavenged computers. It was built in freezing rooms, debated over couscous, and coded by researchers using hacked train ticket terminals. And they did all of this because the well-funded academic mainstream deemed their work completely dead.
Dead end.
So the question to mull over is this. What currently dead or ridiculed idea in the world today, perhaps being worked on by someone in a freezing room right now, is actually the seed of our next technological revolution?